This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Thanks for joining us. For the past few weeks, we've been asking all of you, our listeners, to use your smartphones to record a few moments of your day and to share it with us, because we want to hear what your life sounds like. Well, this is what life sounds like the day after Hurricane Ida, when your family lives in New Orleans, but made the choice to evacuate.
So we're at Vincent's house here in Pelham, Alabama.
This is the voice of my mother-in-law, a fourth-generation New Orleanian. Now, she gave me permission to record our phone call on Monday, and ours was a conversation repeated with slight variations by tens of thousands of families on Monday when the raging winds of Category 4 Hurricane Ida finally slowed. And it's a conversation we've had after other storms. First, you ask about the family.
So my sister Iris is with her extended family. Corey and his wife and the kids and the mother-in-law and brother-in-law, they are all in Atlanta. I'm not sure what they're going to do because they planned on leaving on Wednesday. Dia and her kids went to Houston, but they're back, but they're going to find a place with electricity tonight to stay. Ava and her son Mike, they're in Houston, and Aunt May is in Columbus, Mississippi, so we're scattered all over.
Then you find out about the neighbors.
I guess there's a hole in the roof. And she's trying to get a blue tarp because she says the upstairs bedroom has a hole in it.
Only then do you inquire about the house and any damage it might have sustained.
My neighbor says that from what she could see, my house looks okay.
And eventually, when you're talking to New Orleanians, the deep-rooted, born at charity hospital kind, the ones whose first question when they meet a stranger is always, "Where'd you go to high school?" On the day after a storm, those New Orleanians will eventually begin to reminisce, sharing memories of other storms survived.
You know, we grew up in New Orleans. I can remember there was Hurricane Betsy, and there was another hurricane that was two hurricanes that were really bad when we were little, but people didn't really evacuate then, you know? I remember the hurricane when it came through and decimated the Lower Ninth Ward where my grandmother lived. And there was the one that came through. We were living in Rosemont Place. We didn't get any damage. We just didn't have electricity for a very long time, you know. But we had never evacuated before. It just never seemed, you know, just listening to it on TV, but we stayed.
The assumption of just staying, well, that all changed 16 years ago when Hurricane Katrina prompted my family to do what they'd never done before, evacuate.
We were just lucky we left for Katrina, you know. When we were listening to the weather, when the popular weatherman, Bob Breck, said, you know, his family was leaving, you know, Jim and I kind of looked at one another and said, well, you know what, the weatherman is leaving, you know. we better get out of here, too. We had, like, a convoy. It was, you know, James, Jason and Martha, a dog, Iris and her dog, my mom, Marshall.
And it's these memories of Hurricane Katrina and of all that was lost when the levees failed that kept so many of us far-flung children up late into the night as Hurricane Ida approached. August 29. I mean, that date is etched in New Orleanians' memories as surely as birthdays, anniversaries, and holidays. That Category 4 Hurricane Ida was threatening the city on August 29th. It was enough to tie our stomachs in knots and to prompt so many of our family members to evacuate. Fortunately, the levees held. Here's New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell.
It did not happen. We did not have another Katrina. And that's something, again, we should all be grateful for. However, the impact is absolutely significant. While we held the line, no doubt about that. Now is not the time for reentry.
But before it was downgraded to a tropical storm early Monday, the hurricane brought catastrophic flooding, high storm surges, and 150 mile per hour winds to low-lying coastal communities like New Orleans. The storm surge was powerful enough to temporarily reverse the flow of the Mississippi River. And most critically, Hurricane Ida toppled a transmission tower that provides electricity to New Orleans. The photos of the electrical tower lying in the river make it pretty clear just how long it's likely to be before the 1 million residents without power can once again light the darkness, cool their homes, or refrigerate their food. All of which leads me to ask the one question which proves I came to New Orleans' identity through marriage rather than birth. I actually asked my mother-in-law if this is enough. If facing a month-long evacuation or having to brave weeks without electricity finally is enough to make her and my father-in-law consider moving. Ultimately, it's a silly question. They're New Orleanians, and like any tree with deep roots and broad branches, New Orleanians do not transplant easily.
I think just this time, you know, just kind of thinking like, you know, this is really crazy, you know, thinking that people could live any place, you know, so that, you know, every year you don't have to sit and wonder, is this the year we're going to have to evacuate? But, I mean, you know, this is where we've been, you know, this is where our investments are. You know, we have a house, and normally New Orleans is a nice place to live. It's just hurricane season, you know, which seems to be more frequent lately to me.
Did y'all catch that? My brilliant, kind mother-in-law flipped that question about moving into a conversation about climate change. They're not going anywhere. Which means more hurricane seasons and more conversations that sound just like the one you just heard. Here to help us think about Hurricane Ida and what the storm means for the city of New Orleans is Sarah Gibbons, environment writer at National Geographic. Sarah recently wrote about how Ida could reshape New Orleans. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Melissa. Happy to be here.
And also with us is Oliver Lachlan, U.S. Southern Bureau Chief for The Guardian. Oliver, great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
So, Oliver, I can hear that you're clearly joining us by phone. Can you tell us what you have seen on the ground there over the past 24 hours or so?
Sure, yeah. So I'm based in New Orleans for The Guardian and was here when Ida hit. It was an incredibly intense, pounding storm. I myself rode it out at home. I live in the French Quarter. My roof started leaking. We had some roof damage and wind damage as well. And I've kind of been out in reporting in the city throughout the past 24 hours. A lot of people incredibly traumatized, obviously being reminded of what happened here 16 years ago to the day, which is when Katrina hit the city. A lot of people very thankful that obviously the levee protection system that has received a multi-billion dollar investment from the federal government over the years held, and there hasn't been substantial flooding. But now people really kind of coming to terms with, A, the damage to their own homes, and B, the fact that there is no power anywhere in the city, which is obviously having already a devastating impact on people's lives.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a bit. I think, you know, for folks who have maybe experienced a power outage for 24 hours, maybe even for 2 or 3 days, you have a sense of sort of why it's irritating or annoying. But talk to us a little bit about what this may mean for the city to be without power for weeks on end.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of unfolding and people are just kind of starting to grapple with the fact that that's a real possibility. For me, myself, I am struggling to kind of file updates and stories to my news desk. You know, obviously it's much more acute in communities around the city. So, you know, I spent some time out on the West Bank and people who were kind of hit hardest by the storm now kind of grappling with the fact that maybe they didn't bring in enough food to prepare for the next few weeks. Not really sort of comprehending the fact that, you know, long-term power outages could have been a possibility. And so people are looking to whether they can evacuate. Some people simply don't have the means to do that at the moment. And so, you know, kind of sitting around in humid homes, incredibly hot and humid here, as you know, and really just kind of trying to figure out what to do next. It's a very difficult situation and obviously difficult in different ways in many different communities here.
Sarah, I want to bring you in here because as Oliver's talking about sort of maybe not having brought in enough food and all of that, I always try to emphasize to folks when we talk about Hurricane Katrina that it did matter that it hit on the 29th, which of course is also now true of Ida. Too late in the month if you receive a check at the start of the month, but not late enough if your you know, monthly check comes on the last day of the month. Like the 29th is genuinely a disastrous day for disaster to hit for folks who are living paycheck to paycheck, which is a lot of working people. Can you talk to us a little bit about other ways that what we're seeing in Ida is a return to the experiences of Katrina, even with the levees, thank God, holding.
Yeah, I mean, I'll also point out, too, that this storm spun up so much more quickly than Katrina. People were really caught off guard and had only just a few days to try to prepare for this storm. In a lot of ways, you know, you mentioned the levee system that held, thankfully, after this storm. But Ida is exposing that the electrical infrastructure of the city still needs a lot of work. And so there's still a lot of ways that the city needs to adapt to these really dangerous storms.
And my mother-in-law said, Sarah, that she feels like hurricane season is now longer than when she grew up there or when her parents grew up there, that it's more intense. Is that borne out by the data?
We're not necessarily seeing more hurricanes in sort of the official tally or lengthening of the season. But, you know, with warming atmospheres and the warming ocean, we are seeing more major hurricanes, these category 3, 4, 5 hurricanes hitting the Gulf Coast. You know, last year, Southwest Louisiana saw 2 major hurricanes back to back, Laura and Hurricane Delta. And so these storms, when they do manage to form, are growing a lot stronger than they may have in the past.
Oliver, I'm thinking about the saying that, you know, in military strategy, that we're always fighting the last war. And it certainly felt, just in my own social media feeds, as I was following friends and family who were making decisions about whether or not to leave, that we were preparing for the last hurricane, or not actually not the last one, but the big girl back 15 years ago, Hurricane Katrina, that the worry was about levee failure, but not about electrical failure.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a very difficult decision for a lot of people whether to go or stay. A lot of people I spoke who stayed behind this time are people who actually evacuated during Katrina. And as Sarah mentioned, for a lot of people, that choice was basically taken away from them by the fact that this storm formed so quickly. You know, it came out as a tropical depression on Thursday and basically was here by Saturday evening, which is really not a huge amount of time. One guy I spoke to in the lower ninth ward who had evacuated during Katrina said he was kind of watching news reports, basically, you know, 12 hours before, watching the category go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. So people basically, in many instances, just had the choice taken away from them. They weren't sure what to do. And by the time that they had decided they were going to evacuate, it was basically too late. It was gridlock on the highways, no way of getting out. So they had to batten down the state.
Sarah, I'm wondering about the ways that this experience, which is really just beginning in many ways in New Orleans, because now we're looking at weeks without power, might shape the city, might shape questions about the size of the population and also the composition of the population.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to point out, too, that New Orleans for the past 18, 19 months has really been struggling with the COVID-19 pandemic. They've seen unemployment rates as high as 15% in certain times of year, because this is a largely tourist-based economy that the city has. And so it's been really hit hard by COVID. They're going to be trying to recover at a lower point than they might have if they hadn't seen COVID-19 cases recently spiking. After Hurricane Katrina in 2005, the city lost about half its population. That didn't hit equally either. You know, before Katrina, you had 2/3 of the city's residents were Black. Now it was about half before Ida. And so whether or not the city will be able to continue regaining some of its population that it was starting to recover since Katrina, I think before Ida, it was a little over 300,000, remains to be seen. If those improvements will be made.
Right. And it's worth pointing out that when you lose population, you lose tax revenue, which makes it harder, right? It's hard to maintain city infrastructure for 700,000 people or 500,000 people if only 300,000 people live there and pay into the property taxes.
Absolutely. And it also has an impact on businesses. My colleague, Laura Parker, spoke with Allison Plyer from the data center in New Orleans, and she described this sort of chicken or the egg problem. You know, you have you need people to return so that the Home Depot opens, but you also need the Home Depot to be open so that people can return and begin to rebuild their homes. And so which one comes first is a sort of waiting game for a lot of people.
Oliver, as you have talked to folks, so, you know, I talked to my mother-in-law, she's evacuated at the time, but it's pretty clear that despite, you know, being senior citizens, she and my father-in-law will be returning. They will be working to address and rebuild in whatever ways they have to. As you've talked to folks who are there in the city, are there people who are talking not just about evacuating, but potentially departing in a more long-term sense?
I haven't spoken to anybody who's been talking about departing in a long-term sense, but there was a sort of clear feeling in some of these communities I was speaking to in the West Bank that the next hurricane that comes along, they're not going to try and wait it out. It's just too traumatic of an experience to sit through having your house pounded by wind and rain, to lose your roof, to worry that you're going to die. And so I think for a lot of people, this was potentially a turning point. And as Sarah mentioned, you know, these intense category 3, 4, 5 hurricanes are getting more frequent due to the climate crisis. And, you know, one of the key factors contributing to that in New Orleans is obviously coastal erosion that's happening. That was some sort of protection for the city, but as more and more of the coast gets eroded, that protection is being lost, rising temperatures as well. So I think whether people are conscious and linking that to the climate crisis themselves, I think they are, irrespective of that, saying this is just not something that we want to sit around and wait out any longer. You know, the next time one of these comes along, we're going to evacuate as soon as we hear about it. And that to me felt like quite a marked shift.
So Oliver, I'm not surprised to hear that New Orleanians are not talking about departing long term, but there is this other set of decision makers, businesses, and industry. And so again, already it is mostly a tourist area, one that has lost so much business as a result of COVID and having, you know, responsibly to close many of the festivals that bring in tourists. Have you heard sort of any talk of, on the economic side, about the possibility that folks who are, you know, the Home Depot, basically, you know, in the broadest sense, might not be returning?
It's very difficult for me to kind of update information about this sort of stuff, and I'm just because I don't have power as well. But what I can do is kind of refer back to what has happened over the COVID pandemic. I've been very anecdotally, like, you know, a number of businesses near where I live, which is a kind of tourist hub, closed down and not reopen. And, you know, again, in kind of conversations with friends who work in that industry, people observing that they have a lack of staff and inability to hire people. And so, you know, this is going on as the pandemic is still ripping through this region. You know, there's low vaccination rates in Louisiana, Mississippi. Hospitals were an all-time high just a couple of weeks ago. Really, we're not just talking about the effects of a hurricane. We're talking about, you know, a year and a half of sustained economic downturn due to the pandemic. So it's incredibly worrying.
Sarah, I'm wondering about lessons that could be learned from Puerto Rico and the months and months without power after Hurricane Maria. Are there things that we can learn about what went wrong there, about the federal government's response, about local response that could maybe go better in this post-Ida moment in New Orleans?
Yeah, I think the longer we wait to address some of these disasters, the worse they're going to become. You know, in a lot of ways, New Orleans suffered after Hurricane Katrina for a really long time. But in a number of ways, the city also improved as well. The school system before Hurricane Katrina hit in New Orleans was immensely struggling. After Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of investment made and a lot of improvements. Of course, it hasn't been made perfect, but it's significantly better than it was before. So the longer people are left without jobs, without infrastructure, and without their homes, the worse these types of disasters tend to become.
Sarah, I might have to have you back. We could have a little fight about the post-Katrina public schools and the question of what happened there. But it's a good point about the question of investment and also of community building. And certainly the post-Katrina schools are one thing. And I'm realizing we will be facing the post-Ida schools because kids can't go to school without power. And it's, again, after a whole year of remote learning from COVID. So Sarah Gibbons is an environment writer at National Geographic, and Oliver Lachlan is the U.S. Southern Bureau Chief for The Guardian. Sarah, Oliver, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. On Monday, the United States finished the evacuation process for troops in Afghanistan, one day ahead of the August 31 deadline set by President Biden. Since October of 2001, 800,000 U.S. service members have served there. More than 20,000 have been wounded, and somewhere between 2,300 and 2,500 U.S. military members have lost their lives in Afghanistan, including 13 lost in the bombing at Kabul airport last week. The Taliban is now in power. I want to turn to our veterans to begin to understand how at least some of them are feeling about this moment. Joining me today to discuss how our military veterans are coping on this last day of U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan is Tim Kudo, a Marine veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. Tim, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Your recent op-ed in the New York Times is entitled, "I Was a Marine in Afghanistan and We Sacrificed Lives for a Lie." Can you tell me, if you can, what you mean by that, especially in this moment?
I think for 20 years, we were kind of sold a bill of goods in Afghanistan as to what we could accomplish there. And that was presidents of both parties, first George Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and, you know, finally now President Biden ending the war. But during those times where we were, you know, continuing the war, escalating it, particularly the Obama surge, there was a belief sold to us that we could achieve the goals of nation building, of creating a stable democracy there, of training the Afghan security forces to repel the Taliban once we leave. And, you know, there's a whole narrative that all the generals in charge, all the presidents took their advice and accepted it. You know, ultimately, we found out that they didn't believe themselves through, you know, reporting in The Washington Post about the Afghanistan papers. And so to realize that, you know, soldiers, sailors, airmen and Marines were just sent over there, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, to get injured and killed for something that nobody in charge really believed could be won was incredibly dispiriting. And I think we've seen in the end, particularly in the past few weeks, the rapid takeover of the country by the Taliban, just how fraudulent a lot of those lies were.
Dispiriting is a very understated word to use in this moment, and I appreciate that. But I'm also wondering what the long-term consequences might be already in a nation where so many don't trust our systems, our structures, to feel that particularly in this moment, in this space, the one thing your country should only ask you to do and be honest with you about, that maybe there is a reason to distrust, again, both parties on this question.
I think it's deeper than parties, though. I think there is an issue with the kind of trust that the American citizens give to people in uniform. Obviously, the American military has been one of the most trusted institutions in the United States for the past 10, 20 years, particularly during this time of war. And the fact is that many of those generals put on those uniforms, went to Congress and lied to the American people about what they were seeing on the ground, about their own personal beliefs about the ability to win the war. And then likewise, you know, the powers of the presidency kind of clothe them in a sense of trust when they can. They're in front of the White House or in the Oval Office and they tell you, look, we're going to war. This is what we're doing. This is why it's important. I think people are inclined to give all presidents the benefit of the doubt. And the reality is that, you know, not only did they lie about a lot of these things, but they also were incredibly incompetent in their execution of the lies that they were trying to sell us on too. You know, when we went over there to train the Afghan army, they put numbers on the board and they got the Afghan army and police up to 300,000 people, and that vanished overnight. So clearly there was just kind of a Ponzi scheme going on. And when, you know, the cards fell, the whole thing came tumbling down, not to mix metaphors. But I think this is the issue here, is that, you know, ultimately the American people think that our military particularly can solve almost any problem. It's quote unquote the greatest military in the world, the most powerful military in the world. And in fact, it has incredibly limited use. It can accomplish very small tactical objectives. It can win battles, but it cannot transform a country. And it was a lie to believe that it could in the first place.
Tim, pause with me for just a moment. This is The Takeaway. We'll be right back. Back on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we've been talking about the effect of the withdrawal from Afghanistan and how that's being received by our military veterans. With me once again is Tim Kudo, a Marine veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. So Tim, I'm deeply interested in the point you were making as we took our break. So what is it that, rather than sort of labeling our military simply a failure, I think it's so important the way you were framing that. What is it that we can achieve with our military?
You know, it's a good question. Certainly counterinsurgency, which is what we attempted to do in both Iraq and Afghanistan with limited effects, may be too much for the American military, given how it's trained and equipped now and the priorities given to it to achieve. Certainly, we can conduct a massive airlift at an airport to get more than 100,000, you know, Afghans and American civilians out of a dangerous country with loss of life, but minimal loss of life. And that's the reality of all war. There's going to be casualties. There's going to be people killed. And so we should accept that that's going to happen when we use our military in any way and try and minimize it, do everything in our power. But I think, you know, it's geared, the American military is geared towards high scale, high intensity conflict with other great powers going against tanks and armored divisions and things of this nature. And the type of wars that we're fighting, particularly in the Middle East and Africa, aren't those kinds of wars. And even when we rely on special forces to do the kind of surgical strikes that I think a lot of Americans have become used to and just accept as, you know, an endemic part of our American killing abroad, even then we see that there's regularly serious issues with, you know, violations of the law of war, civilian deaths. And so we need to start looking beyond the military as a solution towards these problems and take a much more all of government approach. And I hope that as we transition away from the global war on terror, that, you know, we accept that problems are not just military problems to be solved, but are actually all of government's problems.
I'm wondering if you have a sense that the American people, maybe the American people through the American media, could have behaved in ways, in different ways over the course of the past 20 years. It's interesting to me that you talk about the withdrawal as something that was actually done well, right? Relatively limited loss of life, swift sort of getting folks out. But of course, it doesn't necessarily feel like that was done well because for once in about two decades, we've been focused very, very clearly on what is happening in Afghanistan. Should we have been paying more attention all along?
Yeah, I think there's been a tremendous skew in media coverage, both in terms of what's emphasized and what's given prioritization, which obviously the past week was given enormous media coverage across almost every outlet and station and paper. And the problem with that is that what you've seen is just what's been going on in Afghanistan for 20 years. The same Marines, sailors, airmen, soldiers getting killed, bombs going off, suicide vests, retaliations with drone strikes where large numbers of Afghan civilians are killed. I mean, that was just the steady state of the Afghanistan war for many, many years. And so for civilians to kind of turn in at the back end and be outraged and, you know, mourning at the Marine Corps Memorial in D.C. and they can't believe what's going on here. You know, it's like you should have just read page A10 of your paper every day for the past, you know, 20 years, and you would have seen this just constantly. And so I think for veterans like me who realize that as Americans basically tuned out, they in large part delegated that responsibility to the presidents and the generals who I have said, you know, have mismanaged this war. And so there's a huge burden that should fall on the American civilian for basically not caring at all about what was happening in Afghanistan until now.
Is there a way that you can imagine as we move forward, being able to direct the American civilian attention more clearly so that we are responsive and responsible to our service members who are, after all, doing this work on our behalf?
Yeah, I think there's two ways. So the first is our connection to Afghanistan doesn't end just because of our military withdrawal. There's still going to be a long, permanent commitment to that country and to its people. I think that would be a good thing. And that's something that the media should really focus on. But I also think that as we go forward, there will be another war somewhere at some time with some new generation. And we have to go back as well to the lessons of 2001, when after the attacks of 9/11, people were terrified, people were afraid, and there was just an enormous consensus that we should go to war. You know, even in the House that voted for the war resolution, you know, only a single rep, Representative Barbara Lee, opposed it. And I think part of that was because when these events happen, as we've seen in the past week with the withdrawal, the media, which shapes the public opinion, can become very, very pro-war, whether through conscious bias or unconscious bias, I don't really entirely know. But we should be aware of that, that we need to create space for diversity of opinions on issues of war and peace.
Tim Kudo, a Marine veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
The last U.S. military flight left Afghanistan on Monday, a day ahead of the August 31st deadline. This departure came days after a suicide bombing at the Kabul airport on Thursday, which killed 13 American service members and roughly 170 Afghan civilians. An ISIS affiliate in Afghanistan known as the Islamic State Khorasan, or ISIS-K, claimed responsibility for the attack at the airport. In retaliation, the U.S. launched two drone strikes over the weekend, one of which killed 10 members of an Afghan family, including at least 8 children, according to the relative of the family. In response to reports of civilian casualties, the U.S. Central Command issued a statement saying that the attack targeted a vehicle that posed an imminent ISIS-K threat to Kabul's airport, and that the casualties may have occurred due to explosives detonating in the vehicle. For more on the U.S. drone strike and the situation in Afghanistan at the moment, we're joined by Andrew Quilty, a journalist based there in Afghanistan. Welcome to The Takeaway, Andrew.
Thank you, Melissa.
Can you talk about what it feels like in Kabul today? And are there still people in the airport who are trying to evacuate?
I haven't personally been to the airport today. However, I can tell you that the atmosphere, because of the lack of aircraft in the sky, both transport aircraft and military aircraft patrolling the skies over the airport in order to support the US withdrawal, have all but vanished, and it has brought a certain level of calm to the city in terms of the atmosphere, I have to say. You know, that the constant drone of large military jet aircraft in the sky, it adds a certain mood which you know, doesn't help anyone's psyche in these very trying, stressful, worrying circumstances.
You've been speaking with the family members of the 10 Afghans who were killed on Sunday. How are they doing right now, and what have they been saying to you?
Well, look, as you can imagine, I mean, there were three families within this extended family who lost members of their direct family. I mean, what can you say? They're shattered. 8 children below the age of 15, I believe, a number of them infants, taken out of nowhere. I mean, who could have predicted this? They certainly didn't. The father who was killed and who was driving the car at the time had been driving home from work. It had dropped off 3 colleagues on the way home. Just before he arrived at home, he came across some of his children and nieces and nephews playing in the alleyway near to their home. Some of them jumped in the car, others followed them into the gate. And it was at this point that the drone strike occurred. And you mentioned in your introduction that the civilian casualties might have been a result of secondary explosions caused by the explosives in the vehicle. I mean, it's not immediately clear whether there was or was not a bomb in the vehicle, but there's no doubt that in my mind anyway, without having ballistic expertise, that the munition that struck this vehicle, I can't imagine how anyone within the vehicle would have survived if the aim of the strike was to disable the person carrying this supposed suicide bomb.
In a moment like this, as I hear you with such humanity report the nature of that loss, how it occurred, we know obviously that it was a U.S. drone. What are the ways that ISIS-K or that other groups in Afghanistan are now talking about this?
Well, look, I think it just puts an exclamation point on a U.S. intervention, which was marred significantly by these kinds of incidents. The difference in this case was that it happened in the most populated city in the country, Kabul, a city of 6 or 7 million people. Whereas over the past 20 years, most of these kind of incidents that have resulted in civilian casualties have occurred in remote districts where there is little access for media, and they largely go unreported. So I think for the Afghans who remain in Afghanistan, you know, some of which tried to get out unsuccessfully, others did not and will be, to different degrees, happy to stay or are just resigned to the fact that they don't have another option, will, I imagine, see this event as just a continuation of the failed aspects of the US military mission that failed and ultimately turned much of the population against them and their allies in the Afghan government and towards the Taliban.
Are drone strikes like this expected to become a more central part of the U.S. strategy now that troops are gone?
It's a very good question, and I think one which we're all waiting to see. It was expected that more covert tactics and strategies would be imposed after the U.S. military withdrawal concluded. It was, however, expected that their allies within the Afghan government and the Afghan National Security Forces would maintain control for at least several months, if not a couple of years. Now, that has obviously evaporated in the last 2 weeks. And so the capacity for the Americans to coordinate these kind of things with human intelligence resources on the ground has gone to almost nil. And anyone who is willing to take the risks to coordinate with American military and intelligence agencies is going to be taking a huge risk at this point, with the country 99% controlled by the Taliban.
Andrew, speaking of taking enormous risks, you're still in Afghanistan. Can you share at all what your plans are and how you're trying to stay safe?
For me and other foreign journalists, I think we can all say that the part of this period that we most feared is probably over. And that was the period in between the governance of the former Ashraf Ghani government and the new Taliban government. The transition itself happened almost as smoothly, with almost not a single bullet fired. Going forward, everyone's holding their breath, I would say, to see how, now that the Taliban have complete control, to what extent that they will consolidate that control and start imposing the kind of harsh laws and restrictions on society.
Andrew Quilty is a journalist based in Afghanistan. Thank you so much for joining us, and please stay safe, Andrew.
Thank you, Melissa.
Oh, and now for the 15-minute opening cutscene. I forgot how awesome Donkey Kong 64 is.
Twitch. It's a platform that's home to millions of users who live stream on their own channels and interact in real time with viewers. It's a great way to connect. But Twitch is also host to some very real problems. Recently, a number of Black content creators on the platform began speaking out against the hate raids that they've experienced. Now, a hate raid is when a creator's chat is flooded with racist, hateful language targeting them because they belong to a marginalized group. And the situation has gotten so bad that several Black Twitch content creators have decided enough is enough. They started a hashtag, #TwitchDoBetter, and they've also organized a protest set for Wednesday. They're calling it a day off Twitch. For more on the Twitch boycott, I turn to
Raven. I am a content creator and activist on Twitch.
So, hi, welcome. If you're new here, oh boy. It is I, your friendly neighborhood Cthulhu.
Raven, or Wreck-It Raven, told The Takeaway about the hate she's experienced on Twitch and how the campaign of #TwitchDoBetter has taken off.
So hate on the platform is not new. That has always been there. But they used to be classified as trolls. And trolls are somebody who kind of just come in, say something out the side of their neck, if you will, and get banned. And that's the end of it. That's always been a thing. But over the course of the last 4 years, since racism became acceptable, people have gotten really brazen. I've had people come in, you know, with bots. Basically, it's usually one or two people who program a bunch of bots to bypass security measures that are put in place and just spam a broadcaster's chat with very inflammatory, derogatory language. That has been on the uptick. I happen to be a Black person that likes alternative clothing and music. So the first thing that I saw at the very beginning of this was a bunch of bot accounts coming into my chat and saying, hey, is a Black goth a gigger?
Wait, they called her a what? And there's plenty of other racist rhetoric she's heard. Oh, child, I mean, that's a lot to have to deal with when you're on a platform just trying to have a little fun.
So I was taken aback because it was very, very, very pointed. Somebody had sought me out to attack my identity in multiple facets in a single message. So I had basically taken a clip of that, which is about 30 seconds to a minute, and I shared it on Twitter. And that kind of gained a little bit of traction. A week later, same thing happened, except now they were saying things like, this channel is being taken over by the KKK.
So this seems like a pervasive problem. Raven told us more about how she's tried pressing forward.
So again, I clipped that and I sent that out into the Twitterverse, if you will. And that took off even more. And then the day after, I saw somebody else post a screenshot of the same racist rhetoric in their channel. And I was done. I had enough. We should not be having to deal with that in a space that, you know, is supposed to be diverse and inclusive. And so I had quote tweeted that particular person and it was like, Twitch, this is enough. We should not be doing this. And I put in the hashtag Twitch do better and I pushed it and it took off. And I could not have expected it to take off as much as it has.
Fortunately, Twitch did not completely ignore Raven and her fellow activists.
Twitch has responded to me. We actually had a meeting about it, and there's a lot of stuff that I cannot disclose at this time. But I will say the team that I met with does care, and I am grateful for that. But it's not going to stop me from being proactive in trying to achieve this change. One conversation with Twitch is not enough. So a day off Twitch is still going to continue.
Listen, I know that's right. My dad always says the struggle continues. And what Raven told us is that although Twitch responded to her, they also took their time.
When Twitch Do Better started taking off, it took them a couple of days to actually put out a tweet that was not received well by many people, because unfortunately, there is a lot of trust that has been eroded over time due to their lack of communication or due to them saying one thing and not providing it in action. So when I did speak with them, what I can say is that they are planning on fixing things and they are working as quickly as they can. A lot of it is not wanting the people who are responsible for this to have a key to a lock that's not even ready, because these people who are doing these things are smarter than a lot of people are giving them credit for.
Now that makes sense. However Twitch is choosing to address this problem, it's understandable to keep it under wraps. It's not only Black content creators who have been subjected to hate raids and harmful rhetoric.
I know there's a couple of thousand people who are partaking in this event. I know a lot of them are marginalized people, being Black or, you know, Latinx or Asian or what have you. And a lot of them are, you know, part of the LGBTQIA2+ community. A lot of, you know, transgender people are taking off because they have been targeted just as bad.
Raven and her fellow activists intend to push on, even in the face of some pushback from other content creators on the platform.
There has been a lot of, you know, pushback from some bigger creators. And, you know, there are other creators who are asking questions like, well, why is this going to work? And, you know, these are valid opinions to have. But I think, unfortunately, the momentum of the movement did get squandered a little bit. We're still going to push forward. And I will say, we know that a single day off Twitch isn't going to fix everything. We don't expect that. I think there's a lot of little subtleties and nuances that people are overlooking. Mainly the solidarity behind the movement, I think, is major. The fact that it has gained traction, the fact that, you know, there are worldwide news outlets and media outlets who have picked up and reported on this story. Don't count us out.
We asked Raven for one piece of advice she wants to give to other younger content creators who may be scared because of the recent hate raids and harmful rhetoric on Twitch.
I think the biggest thing is nobody can take away who you are, no matter how hard they try. I think that a lot of where this is coming from is jealousy and anger, and that's on them. But you can have a community that is supporting and loving and will lift you up just as you lift others up. I think if you are afraid, you're allowed to be, but don't let fear control you, because you know who you are. And that, at the end of the day, is going to be the most important thing.
My thanks to Raven for joining us and her work around protecting marginalized folks online. Now, we reached out to Twitch for the story, and they did send us a comment saying they are, quote, working hard on improved channel-level ban evasion detection and additional account improvements to help make Twitch a safer place for creators. You can find their full response online at thetakeaway.org. Okay, folks, that's all we have for y'all today. It's nice to be back in the chair and with you. Call us with your show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.